Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Mark Weber from IHR.org, Institute for Historical Review. And we are, of course, talking about history, but also current times, what actually is going on at the moment, the political discourse, political correctness and everything else, all the madness that we see coming out of the Western world right now and how that clashes with some of the other ideologies around the world as well. What do you think will happen now then in Ukraine? Mark, how do you see this? And I think we touched upon this before. We've touched on this with previous guests, but the very basic concept that the satellite states to Russia, the color revolution in Ukraine, what we saw in Georgia, South Ossetia, and all these places have been an active campaign, as I see it, to try to destabilize the old satellite states there to Russia to get them to turn away from the old order of under their dominance and control. And it was very obvious what Putin did when he kicked out all the oligarchs and all that issue. And now the Western world kind of has just turned on Russia and tried to get all of these satellite states with them. Is that an analysis? Do you think it's pretty fair, the situation, or is there anything more?
I think that's pretty fair. I would make a distinction, though, and I criticize a lot of commentators on this. I think a distinction should be made between the United States on the one hand and the West on the other. The West is not united. Yes, it's true that Putin's takeover, as it were, of Crimea has been condemned verbally in Europe, but the one country that has been vehement about it and is making all sorts of noises to take action is really the United States. As soon as the crisis was really getting going, I did an interview with a radio network overseas, and I was asked, well, what are the prospects for war? And I said the prospects for war, I think, are very minimal, very minimal. And the reason I said it with such confidence very early on was that two countries, which I think are litmus test or bellwether countries in this regard, had shown their hand. That was Germany and China. Germany is the most important economy in Western Europe, and immediately the response of Germany was not to become bellicose, to threaten war, because Germany wants to continue good relations with Russia, it wants to continue the flow of natural gas and oil, and it was not going to go along with any really harsh actions by the United States in that regard. And China also made clear they were going to settle back and sort of let the cards fall where they may. And so without backing from Germany and China, of course, other countries, but particularly those two countries, the United States has really very few options. And the response by the United States has been a lot of very, very high-flown, belligerent rhetoric, but very little in terms of real action. The United States announced that it was imposing sanctions not on Russia, but on several dozen Russian individuals. Well, that's essentially meaningless. And this is one more example of how increasingly in recent years the United States ratchets up the rhetoric but has very little follow-through. I could give a number of examples of that. One of them was some years ago when India and Pakistan exploded nuclear weapons. The United States imposed sanctions on those two countries. Well, those sanctions were lifted and everything was forgotten in 2001 because the U.S. wanted support from India and Pakistan over the so-called war on terror. Over and over, the United States will make these pronouncements, whether it's a red line in Syria or big statements, but there's very little follow-through. And part of the problem is that the U.S. ability to snap its fingers and make things happen around the world is far, far less than it was in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, or 80s. The U.S. power position in the world is not what it was in those years, and particularly with regard to Russia, it's not what it was when the Soviet Union fell apart in 1989, 90, 91. As Putin said in a talk just the other day, if you press a spring hard enough, it will recoil. And much of the U.S. Policy against Russia that was carried out during the Yeltsin era is going to be reversed because the U.S. setting up of military bases on the borders of or even in what used to be the Soviet Union, very provocative and hostile actions, were against a Russia that was much weaker and less confident than it is today. And we're going to see more pushback, as it were, by Russia, by China, and by other countries as time goes on, particularly because the United States internally doesn't have anywhere near the financial ability to do things the way it used to, because its policies are being carried out with borrowed money increasingly. Borrowed money, by the way, from countries like China, which the United States also claims to be opposing or trying to stop. So this is part of a larger trend, and we're going to see more of this. Now, I have a great deal of sympathy also for the people of Ukraine and the other areas too, but it's clear that any wise leadership in Ukraine must have a policy, must have an attitude of cooperation with Russia, because the two nations, Ukraine and Russia, have so tight relations by history, by economy, by family relations, that a hostile policy between those countries is really harmful to everybody concerned. And I think and I hope that prudent, intelligent leadership will emerge that will preserve the distinctiveness of Ukraine and the interests of Ukraine people, but also takes into account the very, very important ties that Ukraine has to Russia.
Yeah. Do you think it's a possibility that they will actually also go their own way? I mean, it's always been this kind of idea that, okay, they want to try to be dragged in by NATO and the European Union, of course, and then you have Russia on the other side. But to some extent, I can't help to think that kind of a breakup like this, to a certain extent, is also a positive note of breaking away of the globalist kind of view that you have smaller territories and areas that start to go their own way and do their own thing and live with whom they want to live with and do everything like that. I mean, is that a possibility of something unfold?
There's nothing wrong if Ukraine has a position and a place in Europe or in Eurasia similar to Finland. It can still be prosperous. But NATO is a historical relic. It really shouldn't exist.
Right.
Its purpose for existence disappeared in 1990-91 with the end of the Soviet Union. That NATO has no real valid reason for existence anymore, except as a tool, I think, primarily of the United States, which has obviously, clearly been carrying out actions that are hostile to Russia. For example, the U.S. has military bases in Poland. Officially, the United States claims that its military presence in Poland is directed against Iran. That's a palpable, stupid lie, and everyone knows it, really. But this is U.S. Military bases in Central Asia are also directed at Russia. That is, there's no good reason for any of that. And I think that NATO's shouldn't be expanded into Ukraine. I think NATO shouldn't really exist as an entity. What's really, I think, important for Europe is some sort of a closer confederation of the European states that upholds the interests of all of European peoples who have so much in common, not just culturally, of course, but also economically as well.
When it comes to the control of the European Union, I wanted to be curious here and wanted to ask you more about this view, the counter current theme, if you want to call it that, that Germany is really in charge of the European Union. This is basically because of, you know, the economic situation and everything else. And of course, as Germany has been also asked and tasked to pay the bill for certain other bailouts in other countries, etc., they of course want to put, you know, policy enforcements on those areas. To a certain degree, who couldn't understand that, right? But there's this other kind of idea here that there is Germany is really basically there's an old Nazi faction still directing economic policies in Germany. And there's one potential proof for that, and it's called the Red House Report. It was written by an Adam Libor. It was only published in the Daily Mail out of the UK in 2009. And I think the full the technical title for the document was EWPA 1288. And it was basically written that this was it was like to rebuild the Fourth Reich and doing this in economic means through industrial planning and everything else. I haven't been able to actually find any backup of that document or any other correlating source for that. What do you think about that idea?
I was in Germany a few months ago. I talked to many people there. I lived in Germany for 2.5 years. I follow events there very much. The German mood, and I was there during the election campaign when the CDU or Merkel was returned to power. The mood in Germany, and I think this is shared by people both in power and ordinary people, is simply to try to hold on to a fairly prosperous, good life. That's overwhelmingly the mood. Germans have been so bludgeoned by the defeat of the Second World War and the, you might say, the indoctrination in the years since, that they barely trust themselves as a people or as a government. Angela Merkel and her government is remarkably unprovocative. It takes care always to put things in the most, in the least offensive way. But at the same time, Germans are aware that around Europe, and especially in southern Europe, everybody's expecting Germany to be the country that provides the money and the center of financial economic power to keep things in place. But I think some very serious economic problems are going to come up in Germany in the years ahead. And and Germany itself is going to face some very serious problems. So Germany's ability to have its clout is going to also decline in the years ahead as well. But still, it's the most important state in Europe economically and population and so forth, at least in Western Europe.
Yeah.
But I don't know about this report you're talking about, so I can't really comment on that. But that's my sense of the mood, not only of Germans in general, but even of the leadership, is just to sort of carry on in the most prosperous way. After all, for most Germans, this has been a very good period. Germany is relatively prosperous. This is the longest period without war in most of Europe in its history.
Yeah.
And they want to keep it that way. They want to go on vacations. They want to live well. And they don't want to upset the boat and rock the boat.
Exactly. Now, Germany has been gouged over and over again in different, times, basically. Do you know how much money Germany pays each year to Israel?
I've got on our website, we have some figures about that. It's a little out of date. Germany pays more than any other country except the United States to Israel. But it's less important as time goes on. But it's still a significant thing. It was much more decisive and important in the 50s and 60s. It's still somewhat important, but more important than the money is the diplomatic support that Germany gives. If Israel were held accountable in world forums, particularly in the Security Council of the United Nations, Israel would be quickly crushed in a vice because it would be subject to sanctions, and the United States has been vetoing that. But this is part, in Germany above all, of the legacy of the Second World War, which more or less explicitly, Angela Merkel has made this very clear, the Federal Republic of Germany to be truthful to itself as the result of the defeat of Germany in the Second World War is and will be and continues to be a supporter of Israel. That's ideologically part of what it sort of has to be. That's the price it pays, as it were, for having lost the war.
Yeah.
And that's why Germany will probably be the least realistic country in one way going forward because of the unique place that Germany had in its defeat at the end of the Second World War.
How do you view the treatment overall of Germany? What happened during and also, of course, after the Second World War? There's a lot of stories, and we've been highlighting a few of them as well on our website, in terms of, we hear about, well, a lot of people now, they of course know about the firebombing of Dresden. We have the Eisenhower's death camps, where a lot of Germans died. It was another good website, Justice for Germans. I don't know if it's .com or something else. We can link that up as well. That shows some of the documentaries of this as well. What happened there?
And that website, by the way, has quite a few items from the IHR and by me as well.
Yeah.
One of the important things about Dresden is not just the horrific nature of the firebombing in mid-February 1945, but it's the high point or the most obvious example of a policy by the United States and Britain in 1943, 44, 45 to kill as many men, women, and children in unoccupied Germany as possible by bombing. And this campaign was openly called in the American media and in internal documents a terror campaign. I mean, it's really remarkable to hear American leaders complain or talk about their big crusade against terrorism. The bombing campaign against Germany, of which Dresden was just one example, there are many others as well, of course, was explicitly acknowledged as a terror campaign, as a campaign that the goal of which was to kill just as many people. And they did. They killed huge numbers, 500,000, 600,000 civilians, in addition to, of course, and the killing continued, especially by the Soviets, after the war was over. The defeat was so horrendous that it's really, I think, broken the backbone of Germany as a sort of strong, virile, if you will say, or healthy society. But, I mean, one can argue about that. But anyway, that was, the defeat was really total, and it's been fortified. That defeat has been strengthened by years of indoctrination, or what they call re-education, to teach the Germans that they are bad people, they shouldn't even trust themselves, preserving Germany or Europe in a real way is a bad thing because it has echoes of the terrible years of 1933 to 1945.
Yeah, it's really an extraordinary story that are actually and there's just so much filth under that rug that needs to be examined and looked at. What? How do you view some of the leaders at the time? We can talk about. I think you've written quite a bit on Churchill as well. He has some interesting quotes about Germany and Germans and the very idea that there has seemed to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there seemed to be a decision even before the Second World War broke out to crush Germany to whatever extent they can. This came from many different angles. We have, for example, Theodor Neumann Kaufmann, the book Germany Must Perish, for example. That's from one end. You had the idea of the Judea declared war on Germany, the boycott against German goods earlier as well. And some of the other things there as well. How do you tie together that picture of what actually happened? Is there a conspiracy with the entire World War scenario of actually trying to crush Germany?
Well, there are two things to say about that. One is British policy in a more general way and Winston Churchill in a more specific way. I think everyone who has read or studied or tried to familiarize himself with the personality of Winston Churchill is struck that this was a man who reveled war. War was a fun thing for him. And more specifically, his political career was at an end in the 1930s unless there was war. His only way to have a career, to be somebody important, was in war. And he liked war. This was true in the First World War. It was true in the Second World War. Contrary to his image as a big defender of democracy, he was an imperialist, he was a racist, he was everything very politically correct by the standards that we normally apply in judging people today. But because he was anti-Hitler, everything else is sort of forgiven because that sort of the fact that he was against Hitler, that supposedly makes everything okay. But more than that, in his own multi-volume history of the Second World War, he points out that a speech he gave in 1936, he quotes himself as saying that he is opposed to Germany, not because it's Hitler, but because it's the dominant power on the continent, and that this is consistent with the longstanding British so-called balance of power policy in Europe to oppose any state, whether it's France, Spain, Germany, that was going to be the dominant power on the continent. Now, the tragedy for Britain is that this policy, which was sort of workable up until the end of the 19th century, was no longer feasible after the unification and development of Germany at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, because Germany was so much more powerful and economically important that Britain could only really carry out that policy after 1900 by engaging in wars that were going to be so destructive they would destroy even England. Even Britain would be destroyed in the process. And the Second World War is the best example of that. Britain didn't really win the Second World War. It ended up only on the side of the two great powers that did, quote, win, the United States and the Soviet Union. You could say two outer European states, both of them promoting versions of a kind of universalist, arrogant, I think, ideology that insisted that its way of doing things was the way the whole world ought to be, both in the United States version and in the Soviet version. Of course, they were rivals too, but Britain was the defeat of Germany and of other states in Europe wasn't just a defeat for those states. It was really a defeat for Europe, and ultimately, I think it was even ruinous, ultimately even for Britain. It meant the destruction, really, of everything that Churchill even claimed to be. He claimed he was fighting to preserve the British Empire. Well, he did so at the, he continued the war at the cost of the very things he claimed he was trying to uphold and defend.
Yeah, there is another quote, we pulled that out, put it on the website a while back as well. It says, you must understand, this is Churchill, Winston Churchill speaking, said, you must understand that this war, speaking about World War II, is not against Hitler or National Socialism, but against the strength of the German people, which is to be smashed once and for all, regardless whether it's the hands of Hitler or a Jesuit priest. Have you been able to verify if that's a correct quote?
I haven't verified that quote, but there's, as I said, there's a very similar one in the first volume of his multi-volume history of the Second World War, The Gathering Storm.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had a few minutes, I could even get it. And he says something very similar to that. I mean, that it's consistent, again, with the... He says that it's opposing Germany because whether it was France under Philip II, I mean, Spain under Philip II, whether it was France under all sorts of leaders throughout its history. Of course, people forget that the longest-standing hostility for Britain over its history wasn't Germany, it was France, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But France has always had that position to manipulate or maneuver with other powers to destroy any power that seemed to be dominant on the continent. And Churchill is explicit about this. But again, for the rhetoric that he espoused during the war, he claimed, no, he was against Germany because Hitler was uniquely evil, he was terrible, he had to be destroyed. But again, that's just nonsense, because Churchill, in order to do that, made an alliance with a state, the Soviet Union under Stalin, which was, by any sort of objective standards, certainly at least as evil, or, you know, these words are very, very elusive, as Germany. And as he even says, he even concludes in his multi-volume history of the Second World War, Churchill concludes that the great tragedy of the war is that they emerged at the end of it with greater dangers from the Soviet Union than they ever had if Hitler had even won. That's the crazy, terrible tragedy of the war. Britain went to war in 1939 against Germany, declared war on Germany, over supposedly the independence of Poland. Well, at the end of the war, Poland had been thrown to the Soviet Union, not just Poland, but all of Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
Britain had betrayed the very principles it claimed it had gone to war against, gone to war for in the first place.
It's a very good point there about the balance of power. I remember the was another book by E.C. Knuth, Empire of the City, where he details a few of the different allegiances that England has to the different countries, and goes through basically the timeline, the chronology of how they 1 year can basically work with Russia, and the next they join up, you know, against Russia with the enemy that they fought the year previous. And it's just this amazing back and forth to maintain, right, kind of this balance of power in this position as well. That's very, very, very weird and interesting when you read that timeline. But where do you think that this, in terms of Churchill, if we go back that to a little bit, where does this hatred comes from against Germany and Germans then?
Well, that gets into a psychological thing, but I think part of the reason is certainly the success of Hitler's Germany economically in the 1930s was an astonishing thing, something that was by Hitler's very success. I mean, this is a point I've written at some detail about this. It's forgotten just how uniquely successful Hitler was after taking power in 1933 to solve the problem of unemployment and to revive Germany's economy in a way that was spectacularly more effective than the measures taken in the United States or Britain or any other country. So that by 1939, Germany was this extraordinarily dynamic, successful state that by its very example was a threat, I think, to Britain and even to the United States, and of course was considered intolerable to Jewish groups because it was a state that was successful while being uncompromising or fairly uncompromising about Jews, not allowing Jews to have economic or cultural political power. And its very existence was something for many people in Britain and the United States was intolerable and meant that a war against this state was inevitable.
Why do you think that Dresden, if we go back to that for a moment, was targeted in the way it was? I've read a couple of accounts of this, that it was largely very much symbolic in that way, the way that what the town represented, how it was built up, even the beauty of it to a certain extent, that this was to, like, right, you know, push a final kind of nail in the coffin, if you will. What's your take on why they targeted it?
Right. Yes. I mean, almost everyone acknowledges that there was no rational, reasonable military reason to have destroyed Dresden. It was attacked in mid-February 1945. Germany was rapidly falling apart. This Red Army was advancing very rapidly. The last major German offensive in the West, the so-called Battle of the Bulge or Ardennes Offensive in December 1944, had failed. And the end of the war was obvious. The city was packed with refugees fleeing from the advancing Soviets. There was no reasonable, rational reason to destroy the city, particularly in the horrible way that it was done. And historians have different explanations. One is that Churchill and the British were trying to impress the Soviets about the power as a kind of warning to the Soviets. That may be. It may be also, I think, the most logical thing. It was just simply a city that hadn't been destroyed. It was part of the continuing British policy and American policy of just destroying and killing as many people as possible, consistent with the policy that had been in place since 1942, 1943 in against the German population. In fact, so horrific was it that Churchill afterwards wrote, I think, a cover-his-ass memo to Arthur Harris, the head of Bomber Command, politely saying, well, maybe we should reconsider this policy of just terror and killing just for its own sake. Mainly, he was concerned that it looks bad. Remember, the bombing of Dresden was reported by even neutral press. Swiss newspapers, Swedish newspapers reported this, and it looked bad because the Allies were carrying out a policy that was so obviously irrational or unreasonable in terms of the ideals it was claiming to uphold.
What do you know about the accounts of what happened to some of the civilians as well? I've read accounts of how women were treated, rapes, all kinds of nastiness went on there.
Well, that's widely acknowledged now, that there was huge mass rape of German women, particularly by Soviet forces. But it was also done in the West, too. And there's material on our website and by me in various talks about this in the West as well. When I was a young man, I was 19 years old, I was in Antwerp, actually trying to sell magazines door to door. And I spent a lot of time talking to people about their reminiscences of World War II. And people said they were they weren't really afraid of German soldiers during the occupation or during the war, but they were afraid of American soldiers at the end of the war, particularly, they said, black soldiers. But all that's been more or less swept under the rug. Because American soldiers were just not as well disciplined as the Germans. They weren't punished in anywhere as rigorous a way for transgressions in the way that German soldiers, if they raped or did something like that, they were very, very severely punished. But again, all of that was really eye-opening. I was a young man. I had been raised with the usual sort of story about World War II, and to hear Europeans tell me how different this was. There's a book that came out last year about American treatment of the French that's really shocking, about the rape by Americans of people in France, in occupied France, that was also swept under the rug or is not very well known. But all of this is largely suppressed and subsumed in this propaganda image that's upheld by Hollywood and so forth, because for the establishment in America, World War II is, has been, and for them must be the so-called good war. It's the test of all other wars. And that's why over and over again, American politicians will compare the bad guy of the moment, whether it's Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi or Bashar al-Assad or even Putin, with Hitler. That's the kind of card that's played. And everyone is supposed to respond by saying, oh boy, well then we better go to war, I guess, because that's the only way you can deal with somebody like that. Again, it was simplistic and false during the Second World War, and it's even more simplistic and dangerously false in the years since then.
Yeah. Oh, indeed. And how many young men on all sides here didn't die during these two conflicts? It's just an amazing this is a Holocaust. This is a tremendous just culling of the herd in these major conflicts. Do you think it's ever possible that something like this will occur and happen again, or was that it?
In that regard, I want to make a point. This is a point that needs to be stressed, that people around the world, I think, do not understand, Americans don't understand. War is something different for Americans than it is for most of the people in the world. For Americans, war is something that happens overseas. It happens far away. Wars for America, the First World War, the Second World War, except for the people who are actually getting killed or in the fighting, is a good time for America. First World War and the Second World War was a time of full employment, prosperity, stores filled, activity. People were doing better. Americans don't think of war in the same way that Europeans or Asians or Middle Easterners do. America has never had bombs fall on our cities or foreign armies tramping around and occupying our lands. We haven't had the real horrors of war visited upon America, upon us, in the way that people in Poland, Germany, Russia, France, Italy, Iraq, Japan, China, and so forth, Russia have had. So that American politicians talk much more loosely about war and about going to war than people in other countries. That's why this kind of sickening, I think cynical talk by Obama about how, with regard to Iran, as he says, all options are on the table. It's a cynical phrase.
Yeah.
I mean, what does it mean? It means what? Nuclear bombs? Invasion? These words carry a tremendous amount of weight. But Americans like to hear this because they don't have the same sense of just how horrific war is in the way that other people have experienced in their, well, not only in their lifetimes, but certainly in the lifetimes then of their parents and grandparents.
Well, exactly. The European continent has been ravaged in that regard. A tremendous amounts of battles and fighting has been going on this continent. But at the same time, then that has given a different kind of attitude, I think, towards a lot of this as well, perhaps. But it's also, on top of that, you have this mentality. We talked with Kevin MacDonald about this as well. That it seems to be then that to at any means necessary, this has been the official excuse, of course, but the reasoning has been to any extent necessary, we need to do whatever we need to do to be able to prevent this from ever happening again in the future, right? That was the reason for the League of Nations, for the very globalist ideas altogether. It might even be the idea for the indoctrination of our youth, the schooling system, and the way that that the Frankfurt School has gotten into the psychological departments, into the education and everything else. What do you think about that, Mark?
Yes, well, that's true, but it's harder and harder to uphold that kind of sloganeering as it was in the past. And one of the big reasons for that is that whereas in 1945, the United States could say, well, we're in favor of this world global organization to run things, which was supposed to be ultimately run by the United States or in Roosevelt's mind, in cooperation with the Soviet Union, those slogans had more of a basis in reality then than they do today, because in the aftermath of the First World War, and even in the aftermath of the Second World War and the First World War, the United States was the one great power that was financially, economically, politically still intact from the ruins of war. So it could, with more justification, put itself forward as the great leader of the world. That's no longer the case. One of the startling contrasts between the United States rhetoric and reality is that American society is no longer admired, even by Americans, in the way that it was in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. The American society is not looked upon by the people around the world as any kind of model to aspire to. It's prosperous, although, again, by all the standard indices or of what makes a prosperous or healthy society, America continues to fall on these lists. It makes it very difficult for American leaders then to claim that we are the great model of the world and the rest of the world should be like the United States, and that we're going to impose or persuade or force other countries to be like the United States. Those slogans and those policies have less and less validity and less and less believability, plausibility than they did in the past.
Well, exactly. And with that comes monoculture. The failed god of democracy is to be exported to every land on the planet now. And that's the name of the game. And of course, in this process, they can manage to get the countries in debt, set up central banks. They can get them involved in all kinds of things that makes them dependable on the larger structure. So there's one extent here in terms of the terminology that we hear in the media, and think about that too, the difference in reaction, let's say how the US supported what happened in Egypt during Arab Spring as opposed to what's happening in Ukraine right now. It's very, it's blatantly obvious that there's much more going on here,
Yes, that's quite right. But one of the startling things is the ham-handed way that the United States tries to manipulate these things is increasingly unsuccessful. The result in Egypt now, and I try to stay in touch with Egyptians over this, is that the United States is looked upon with loathing, contempt, or hatred across the board now in Egypt by those who support the current government, who support the United States has about zero credibility in Egypt. And in Ukraine, the U.S. Interference is so stupid, really, that it can only earn the contempt of people regardless of their political background, whether they're Ukrainian nationalists or pro-Russian or whatever. That's increasingly around the world. The United States interferes, meddles, pushes, prods, threatens, but with the passage of time, with less and less real effect, and with only encouraging all the more resentment and loathing and contempt by people around the world and even by governments. One of the remarkable things about Germany is how much Germans are offended and indignant over this massive surveillance and spying going on in Germany. The Germans say, well, it's illegal. You're violating our law. The attitude of the American government more or less is, well, so what? We don't care. Well, the Germans have this rather naive idea that America should be held to the standards that it claims to promote around the world. And, well, the United States doesn't do that. It hasn't done that. And it means that the credibility, which is an important asset for any society, for any country of the United States, is less and less with each passing year.
I wonder as well, on top of this, I don't want to get too conspiratorial here, although it's important to bring that into the picture as well, but if it's not the point as well, and it might seem weird to people, but if you think about that in the long term, if you think about just the very basic idea that conflict in itself generates reasoning to have army bases all over the world, reasoning to, you know, invade countries, reasoning for conflict, and the whole war machine just operates and continues. If we look at Egypt, for example, then, who second to Israel received the most funds in military aid from the U.S., isn't it then curious that it seems to have been a situation now where they basically potentially have armed yet another enemy? If we have, and I know that, again, this is in the official, you know, world here, but the arming of the, you know, Muslim Brotherhood that as they take over in Egypt, and the potential of another kind of Al-Qaeda-run situation here as well, if you see what I'm getting at, Mark.
Well, you're raising a couple of different points, but I think one of the points you're making is a very valid one. That is, it's what Eisenhower warned about, this military-industrial conflict, a complex, which then has to have conflict to justify its very existence. Madeleine Albright made this point when she was having an argument with the head of the Pentagon, Colin Powell, some years ago, when under the administration of the first George Bush, and he was warning and said, "Well, this is going to be a dangerous thing." And Madeleine Albright says, "Well, what's the point of having this big military if we don't use it?" Well, yes, wars become almost necessary to justify this enormous, enormous expense of deployment of resources by the U.S. Military. As you well know, as I think most people know, the U.S. military expenditure is as large as, well, supposedly the next 20 countries put together, yeah, or half the world or something like that. It's so gargantuanly large. And so there's a strong temptation, of course, to use it and go to war, again, without real consciousness, awareness, or of accountability of just how horrible the consequences are in terms of huge numbers of people who are dead, displaced, wounded, maimed, and, of course, if you want to just be selfish about it, the enormous wasted money that the United States taxpayers are called upon to support these terrible wars.
You know, to me, from the outside, it almost seems in these times as well, when you look at the behavior overall, it's almost like they are seeking to discredit, you know, foreign relations from the United States point of view, in terms of how other people or other countries are going to perceive them. It's almost like they're trying to break its back economically and using the military, and at the same time doing kind of a last push of getting influence in some of the other countries with the aid of the military system. I'm not saying that the empire, if you will, is going to collapse overnight, but I'm saying that it seems like the how United States has been used is something that has changed in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, perhaps. Do you think I'm wrong?
I think what you're putting your finger on, I would describe it slightly differently. I think as the United States becomes less and less a cohesive society, that is, less a nation state, it has to justify its policies not on the basis of national interest, but on the basis of some ideological abstraction. That America, so that those people who justify this course of action over the that we've seen for a long time in American history, do so increasingly with ever more arrogance. We're right, and we're going to do it, because a sensible way that countries deal in the world is in terms of, well, what's right for us. They have a more prudent idea us in the world. They have a prudent sense of who they are, of identity, and therefore of their national interest and of the continental interest or the world interest. But America increasingly is a country characterized, motivated not by national interest in any normal or logical sense of the term, but by ideology.
Yeah.
One example of that: the United States, Obama now claims that an important feature of U.S. foreign policy is promoting gay rights all over the world. Now, whatever you think about whether that's gay rights or good or not good, the idea that this should be a part of U.S. foreign policy is just madness, really.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's trying to impose an ideology. First of all, it shows no sense of history. It says, in effect, Obama is saying, forget the way the United States used to do things. forget the fact that our policy on gays or homosexuals was one time to punish it as a crime. Forget that. We now think we've got it right, and we're so confident that we're right, we're insisting everybody else in the world do it the way we do it now.
Yeah.
Now, that is just unbelievable arrogance and shows no sense of real history, much less a sensitivity to the fact that different people around the world handle this and other questions in a way that we don't. Now, but increasingly, the United States carries out policies based on these abstract ideas or some legalism that has no relationship either to authentic American interests or to a sensitivity of the world as it really is.
I mean, this is just, with the gay rights thing, that's just complete nonsense. I mean, Paul Joseph Watson did a really good report on this that we linked up a while back that basically showed that the idea here of the gay rights issue that the U.S. brings up is all bunk. It, of course, does that illegitimately of trying to put this kind of propaganda nonsense onto Russia, of course, here, that that they are anti-gay and no one actually bothered to read the actual law and what it said, etc. It was just like released in the media and spread like wildfire. While in the meantime, it was pointed out by another, forget the press name there now, but I think it was Human Rights First, that website, that 10 key U.S. allies actually have anti-gay laws that are much, much worse than Russia. We're talking about Uganda, Kenya, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Qatar, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Singapore, and the United Arab Emirates. So why are they not pushing these countries to change the same way?
Right. Well, in addition to the hypocrisy, but the whole idea of even promoting some abstract principle as part of U.S. foreign policy, that is just stupid, really. It's just, but my point, larger point, is to get back to, well, what drives America today? What is the motive force behind U.S. Foreign policy? And it's two things. There's a kind of ideological motive that America's good. We have to be the leader of the world, so we're just going to promote the way we do things everywhere in the world. And the second one is who has power in the United States. And the most important expression of that is with regard to Middle East policy, the enormous power of what's called the Israel lobby, the Jewish lobby, which makes a mockery, by the way, of all the claimed principles the United States supports in every other way. But my point is, it's not only an unrealistic foreign policy; it's a schizophrenic one.
Yeah.
And that's why around the world people can't even make sort of head nor tail of what the United States is really trying to get at, whether it's in Ukraine or Egypt or elsewhere, because it'll cite a democracy or legal international law as a justification one day, and then violate it or blatantly betray that same principle in another country on another day.
Well, exactly. And again, the point there on the fact that they're pro-gay rights and pushing that, but at the same time then says nothing about, for example, privacy rights, the behavior of the NSA, for example, that's okay. Right. You know, there's like anything that's threatening to state power and the, you know, the whatever is happening on that regard with governments and everything else, deny that, refuse to even touch on that. But then when these mundane things, you know, in that regard, in comparison, are brought up, then this is the most important issue of all, you know. But don't look at the NSA, what they're doing. That's all right, you know. You don't have any rights on that arena, you know. So it's all behavioral, you know, rights as opposed to societal or how they implement us in a different way, you know. So it's all bunk, you know. It's just,
well, you know, the discrepancies and the hypocrisy are really so astonishing. I mean, the most important Arab ally, I guess, right now, if you can call it the United States in the Middle East, is Saudi Arabia. Well, this is a bizarre country. It's the only country in the world named after a family. It has no constitution, doesn't even have the pretense of voting. Women aren't allowed to drive cars in the country, and yet that's an important ally, but there's all this finger pointing about democracy in other countries. It's bizarre, really. And the world understands this increasingly. They see this blatant hypocrisy, and therefore people just increasingly can't believe anything. when after the Snowden and Manning revelations came out, Obama went on television and said how happy he was to have this dialogue about surveillance. Well, there wouldn't be a dialogue except that Snowden and Manning released these documents. Otherwise, it'd be all swept under the rug. In fact, it's so swept under the rug that the very existence of a secret court, the so-called FISA court, which issues these orders, surveillance orders, its hearings are held in secret. And the it was part of the Patriot Act, but not even the members of Congress who voted for it understood what they were voting for. That's another aspect of American democracy that is self-indicting. That is, politicians voting for things they don't know what they're voting for. They don't have the time to even read through these book-length laws that they pass or understand, even more importantly, the implications of what these laws are that they're supporting.
Well, exactly. This won't work in the long run. It won't stand. People will get smart to it, see through it, and beginning to question all of this that we've been talking about. And of course, we're well on our way if we can do that as a first step. I want to thank you again, Mark, for coming back on the program, talking about all of this with us. It's always nice to have you on. Of course, we want to have you back in the future again. But please leave us with your website, and if there's anything else you'd like to, you know, get in here before we round things up for this time. So if there's anything else you want to leave our audience with, either if there's something upcoming or just some other positive notes. The floor is yours.
Well, one positive note is that I think that what your work is doing, what our work is doing, will have greater resonance and appreciation as the crisis continues, you might say, to unfold in America and the West. And that's why I think the work that you're doing, that we're doing, I think is very important. And I urge people, of course, to check out, as I mentioned earlier, our website. But the positive note is that all the more solid and well-grounded information, educational work, is all the more important in a time in which the system is in the kind of crisis, as we pointed out, I think, and laid out during this broadcast, during this session.
Very good. Thank you, Mark Weber, IHR.org, Institute for Historical Review. We'll have it linked up, and we'll, of course, say thank you for this time, Mark.
Thank you.
I hope you have a great rest of your day or evening. Have some new things to consider. We'll be taking Monday, the coming week, off due to attendance at the Electric Universe Conference in Albuquerque. But we'll be back on Wednesday again with Vengeance. Judith, Mary Baker, Patrick Henningsen, Stephen McNallan are some of our upcoming guests. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your membership. It keeps us growing and expanding in our productions and in the direction where we can do more. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you soon. Take it easy.